Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. But it's just had a huge victory. They passed Build Back Better. We're going to do a Conversations with Great Minds deep dive. Dr. Justin Frank is going to drop by. I've got a million questions for him. He's the professor of psychiatry at George Washington University. What is the psychology behind creating fear about so-called critical race theory? How do you purge racism from a society? And a whole bunch of questions about how do you know what happens when strong men. I mean, what is this whole phenomena anyway? You know, the Trump Mussolini, you know, that kind of thing. We'll get into that. Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all counts. Anthony Huber was the second person that Kyle Rittenhouse, in my opinion, murdered. Obviously not the jury's opinion, but what can you say that he definitely killed? And his family released a statement, and a statement with which I agree, just to put it on the record, you know, my position on this. They wrote, "There is no justice for Anthony or for Mr. Rittenhouse's other victims, Joseph Rosenbaum and Gage Grosskreutz." This was from Karen Bloom and John Huber, Huber's parents. They continue to say, "There is no accountability for the person who murdered our son. It sends the unacceptable message that armed civilians can show up in any town, incite violence, and then use the danger they have created to justify shooting people in the street. We hope that decent people will join us in forcefully rejecting that message and demanding more of our laws, our officials, and our justice system." Bingo. So, picking up your phone calls, Kenyatta in Los Angeles. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
I just wanted to briefly say that I am up to all 6'3" of my eyeballs with hearing people say that Kyle Rittenhouse couldn't have been a racist because the people he killed were white.
Right.
What animated?
Why
Kyle
were they all there?
Rittenhouse?
Yes, exactly.
Thank you for taking the words from my throat, because what animated Carl Rittenhouse was the fact that it had to do with Black Lives and Black Lives Matter, and more specifically, the shooting of Jacob Blake.
Right.
Were those events absent, there wouldn't have been the demonic presence of Kyle Rittenhouse. And let me say further that history is replete in this country with people who get offed for standing up and or helping black people. I point you to the civil rights workers, Goodwin and Schroner in the 60s.
Yeah.
I point you to JFK, RFK, the girl that was killed, Heather Heather Heyer. So this specious argument, you know, it reminds me of every time, and it's perpetual, that black people are killed at the hands of police in particular, the first thing that's done is they'll trot out, I call this the Django syndrome, they'll trot out some black person and put them in front of a microphone in a uniform and then proclaim, well, see, it couldn't have been racism. Look at what that black person said. They said it wasn't so, so it couldn't be so. And as a black person in this country, I got to tell you, I have had enough of that bovine feces.
Thank you. Good job, Kenyatta. Yeah, I the Rittenhouse, I don't know if you caught it from Pat Buchanan's op-ed. Did you catch that? This is Pat Buchanan.
No, I didn't, Tom.
He says the headline is Kyle Rittenhouse is both right and righteous. He says, and this is a guy who ran for president twice as a Republican. While Rittenhouse's decision to go to Kenosha might have been unwise, it was also unselfish and indeed brave. He was risking his life in a riot to defend another man's property and do his civic duty in a situation of lawlessness. He could have stayed home, as almost everyone in Kenosha did that night while their city was burned and pillaged. No. This is the narrative we're hearing on the right, is that he's a hero. It just blows my mind.
I don't know if you had a chance to read my piece over at Op-Ed News on the Rittenhouse case. It's called Kyle Rittenhouse, The Makings of an American Hero and Patriot.
Yeah, exactly.
If you do get a chance to read it, please
feel free to encapsulate it.
It is Kyle Rittenhouse, The Makings of an American Hero and Patriot. It's over at opednews.com.
Yeah. Adam in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to call because I was really disgusted by the mainstream media news. I don't know if you noticed, but NBC had an interview with Rittenhouse's mother, and then I think ABC had an interview with Rittenhouse's mother
on
Monday.
Yeah, Fox did it first.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too liberal to me, does it?
Yeah, right, the liberal media. There has never been a liberal media in the United States that is the, quote, mainstream media. The liberal media in the United States has always been slightly off to the side. You've got, who was it in Congress last week said, it was Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin said, America's a center-right nation. No, our media is center-right, but when you poll the American people, they're center-left. Steve in Gresham, Oregon. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Last week, we were talking about January 6th and Mike Pence down at the loading dock.
Mm-hmm.
And, the badges wouldn't work. Somebody decided to get Mike Pence into a limousine and take him out of the Capitol.
And he refused.
And
he said, I don't know the driver. He refused to get in the car.
Right. So we need to find out who ordered that driver. If Mike Pence had left the Capitol, and if they had taken him to the Dick Cheney Memorial Secure Bunker, if Congress had reconvened and Mike Pence wasn't there, the president pro tem takes over.
Right, and that was Chuck Grassley, right?
And that was Chuck Grassley, who would have been more than willing to do what Mike Pence was not.
I agree with you. Although, I haven't seen anybody say that out loud, I think that you're probably right, and I think that I think the reason Pence didn't want to get in that limousine is because he knew that there was basically a plan to kidnap him. Specifically so he could be replaced by Chuck Grassley. Now, that is, no major media is reporting that. I think you could right now put that into the category of conspiracy theory or theory that Steve and Tom have. But Steve, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. We need to find out who ordered the driver, who ordered him to get into that car, who is the person who had their badges, so they weren't working.
Yeah.
There's a lot to find out about January 6th.
I'm with you. Steve, thank you. Okay, let's see. Carrie in New Windsor, New York. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
So just about Kyle Rittenhouse going free. I just want to say that the right is so lucky that the left is trained in nonviolence, or else we might take our imaginary M16s and go to the next Trump rally, and like one of us might.
No, we're going to stop. You're going to stop right there, Carrie. You just have to stop.
But
right there.
What he did was he provoked. People provoked him. He went there, and people provoked him. If you look at video of one of the people he shot, he was definitely provoked, but. I don't know, there was like a back and forth maybe thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And then he shot some people, and then he walked right past a whole bunch of cops, and then he got away with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So now all of us can get away with it with murder?
It appears. My big concern about this, and I've said this from the very beginning, is that this thing that came along with the Trump administration of right-wingers, heavily armed right-wingers showing up at protests, is now going to probably double. And the number of people, I mean, this is the third killing that I know of off the top of my head. We had, a guy killed here in Portland. We had, Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville. You've got the people, Anthony Huber and the other fellow who was killed by Kyle Rittenhouse there in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And it seems to me like this is like when Whitman climbed that tower in Texas and did the first mass shooting in, what was it, 1961, I think, or thereabouts. It was back in the 60s.
I don't remember that. That sounds horrible.
Yeah, but it was literally the first mass shooting in America. And within a decade, it was just happening regularly. And it's just such a terrible precedent. It really concerns me.
Well, don't worry, anybody, because we're all trained in nonviolence.
There
you
go.
Just like Martin Luther King and just like Gandhi before him. It's like in our blood, our great whatever's passed it down. And it's like, you had to, when I was 19 at a demonstration, they were like, did you do your nonviolent training yet? You're not really allowed to be here without it, very.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, anyway, okay. So two things. Yesterday on Democracy Now!, there was a fabulous anthropologist who has since passed. His name is David Graeber, and he had this idea that, societies have been more experimental than we think, and maybe an idea is taking turns at hierarchy. And he gave the example of he's sitting there and he's pointing to different people, and he's like, This year, you're a police officer. Next year, you won't be a police officer. And then the next year, you'll be a police officer, and then you won't be. And then when you're not a police officer, everybody will be dealing, will have to be dealing with each other on an equal basis.
Yeah, it's what the Greeks did with their governance. The people who served in were drawn by lottery, just like jury duty.
So I just thought that would be something for people to just think about. Like, it would make people more appreciative.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea, Carrie. David Graeber has been on this program. He did pass away last year. It was really unfortunate. And I just got his new book. He's got a new book out along with another David, whose last name I'm forgetting. But it's called The Dawn of Everything. And I've spent a few hours with it. It's absolutely brilliant. So I thought you might like to know about that. Carrie, thank you for the call. Hierarchy is a fascinating topic. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment by yours truly. This is from Chapter 1, The Unholy Alliance of Racism, Genocide, and Guns. In Isaiah 14:21, the Lord tells Isaiah, "Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers." It's a variation on the old story of karma and seems in a very real way to be playing out today in the United States. America is facing an epidemic, public health officials use that word, of gun-related suicides, accidents, and even homicides and police killings. That epidemic has grown worse in the past decade, largely because the number of guns in America has increased, in large part because of the racial fears of white men who have bought guns in record numbers for 8 years during the time in office of America's first black president. A landmark 1999 study from researchers Franklin Zimmerman and Gordon Hawkins showed that the main correlation, far surpassing mental illness, socioeconomic status, or race, that could be defined as causal in predicting the rates of gun deaths is a simple number, the number of guns distributed among society. In the 30 years since that study, Zimmerman and Hawkins' results have been replicated and reanalyzed dozens of times. As the American Academy of Pediatrics said in a release published in AAAS's Science magazine, quote, "New research shows dramatic differences in the number of children hospitalized and killed each year in the U.S. from firearm-related injuries based on their state's gun legislation, even after adjusting for poverty, unemployment, and education rates. It found twice as many pediatric firearm deaths in states with the most lenient gun regulations compared to states where gun laws are strictest," end quote. They added that this is a critical issue for children, quoting Stephanie Cho, MD, the lead author of the abstract, quote, "Firearm-related injuries are the second leading cause of death among children in the United States. But we found a clear discrepancy in where those deaths happen that corresponds with the strengths of states' firearm legislation. In states with lenient laws, children die at alarmingly greater rates," end quote. And unsurprisingly, America not only has unusually lenient gun laws, but also has more guns in civilian hands than any other country in the world. America has a bit more than 4% of the world's population, but holds almost 50% of all the guns in civilian hands worldwide, more than 390 million guns. And the more guns a society has, the more gun deaths it will experience. The NRA and their army of lobbyists have been quite successful in making this happen. During Obama's presidency, there was a steady and hysterical drumbeat of articles, emails, and political proclamations by so-called pro-gun politicians and think tanks, suggesting that Obama was preparing to take away everyone's guns at any minute. There was even a subtext embraced by the hard right that he wasn't going to stop there. After disarming white Americans, these folks said, Obama was going to intern them in otherwise unused FEMA camps. Flipped-out gun owners were repeatedly arrested during the Obama years, trying to break into retired or temporarily vacant military facilities and toxic waste sites, looking for evidence to prove that Obama was, in fact, preparing the modern-day version of the World War II-era Japanese internment camps. White supremacy was the founding notion of this nation. White Europeans thought themselves so superior to the human beings they met here in 1492 that Columbus himself became the first North American slaver, shipping Taino Indians back to Spain as slaves to the royal family. "A slave is as good as gold," Columbus wrote for the king and queen. Europeans in the Americas then stepped up that game into a hemisphere-wide campaign of racial genocide, pulling off the largest multi-generational mass murder in the history of the world. In the midst of that effort, they also created the legal mechanisms necessary to define and legally regulate slavery, and even built those systems into America's founding document, the Constitution. America was birthed in slavery and genocide, and both needed guns. It was the superior weaponry of guns that gave the European settlers a massive advantage over the bow and arrow-equipped Native Americans, and it was the raw power of widespread white ownership of guns in the South that propped up the institution of slavery for hundreds of years. Without guns, neither would have been possible, or at least neither would have been as easy as they were to pull off. And now, after centuries of guns being used to kill off and keep down people of color in America, those same guns are creating a terrifying epidemic of gun-facilitated violence, from public schools to private homes and public concerts. It's enough to make one think that Isaiah was onto something. Chapter 2, The Sanitized History of America. The United States' expansion and conquest in the late 18th century through the 19th century and into the 20th century is a history written by white men, inked in the blood of Native Americans, and built on the broken and bloody backs of enslaved people brought here from Africa. From 1791, when the Bill of Rights went into effect, until the end of the Civil War, the Second Amendment protected the rights only of white men to own guns. This is simply because until the ratification of the 14th Amendment, states determined who was recognized as a person protected under the Constitution. Initially, in most states, that meant that white men who owned land and paid taxes were the only people considered full citizens under the Constitution. In the South, white men with guns formed slave patrols to control slaves and formed posses to hunt escaped slaves. The book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Dr. Justin Frank is on the line with us. He is the psychoanalyst and clinical professor with the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at George Washington University, the author of Trump on the Couch, Obama on the Couch, Bush on the Couch. Justin Frank, MD, is his Twitter handle, which is really worth following. And Dr. Frank, welcome back to the program, and thank you for joining us for Conversations Great Minds. I have a lot of questions for you. If I could start out, we just saw this victory in Virginia where Glenn Youngkin, you know, ran against Terry McAuliffe. Terry McAuliffe, obviously not the most progressive or the most enthusiasm-generating candidate, but Youngkin basically was saying, I have no platform other than auditing the 2020 election. And one other thing, which is stopping the teaching of critical race theory in Virginia schools, which A, is not happening, and B, seems to me like just code for, you know, we're no longer going to talk about race. What's the deal? What's the psychology? Why does the right hate education, number one? And number two, what's the psychology behind creating fear around critical race theory? And why is it such a potent force in America?
Well, first of all, hi.
Hi.
Second of all, creating fear is actually not exactly what's going on. It's tapping into fear that's already there. It's tapping into fear in our unconscious. And everybody has fear. We have different degrees and we have different subjects about which we're afraid. But when we were kids, we had night terrors that woke us up. We were afraid of the dark, afraid of all kinds of things. And as you grew up, there were phobias. There were people were afraid about what they would eat, be paranoid about this, be afraid of different things. And in fact, when the United States was founded, people were afraid of central government, which is why they had the Articles of Confederation. And then people were afraid of states having too much power. But it was about a fear of being taken advantage of. It's a fear that you're going to be, that something's going to be out of your control. So in some ways, the topic of the fear doesn't matter as much as the fear, the process of the fear. That's the first thing. So Youngkin tapped into a fear that has to do with race, that has to do with a fear that people are going to become, white people are going to become ashamed and embarrassed that they have white skin, that they're going to come home. And I've had some patients, actually, whose kids have come home, who told me in sessions years ago, as one little girl came home to her mom, and she came in and said that she's 9 years old and she's ashamed of being white. And she feels embarrassed about it and ashamed of it. And so there's some anxieties about it. But as far as Youngkin is concerned, critical race theory is an interesting thing because it is not taught in the schools in Virginia. It is taught in the advanced law schools and things. So it's not a subject that doesn't exist. But the issue is really what McAuliffe said that was so problematic was he said that that parents can't tell the teachers what to teach. And that taps into a very serious issue about fear, about control, about parental power, and actually about exercising that power when you're actually discounting the expertise of teachers. And I have a family member who's a teacher in New Jersey, and she said that when Christie was the governor, he set teachers against parents, and it was awful. And she's worried that that's going to happen in Virginia.
So,
I don't know what else?
So,
yeah, go ahead.
So, are you suggesting that Terry McAuliffe, by making that statement, which got amplified a million times by the Youngkin campaign, basically shot himself in the foot more than it was, it was more a bad McAuliffe strategy than a good Youngkin strategy?
Yes, it was a bad McAuliffe strategy because it was used as a soundbite that they just plastered everywhere. I mean, it was a one simple statement. So, I mean, it was like he was either unschooled or he didn't, you know, quite get how what a hot button issue that is.
Right.
Because teachers, I mean, I remember growing up in Los Angeles, they wouldn't allow us to learn about UNESCO, United Nations Education, Scientific Cultural Organization. They wouldn't allow it to be taught in the L.A. public school system, because if you learned about other countries, you would forget about your own. That's oversimplifying it. But that's how it was in the mid-50s.
Well, there was also a big fear of the United Nations, too. I remember that.
Fear of the United Nations, yes. And, and the hatred of the United Nations. And it was about fear.
Mm-hmm.
People were afraid. And I remember when I was a kid, my mother went to a PTA meeting, and she found herself speaking up about all of this because everybody was attacking the UN. And she said, wait a minute, I have a child in the fourth grade, and I think he should learn about the UN. And as the meeting ended, she was afraid to walk to her car because she might be attacked. And somebody came up to her and said, why are you wearing that red dress?
Wow.
You know, because red is the color of communists.
Right.
And then we got a letter in the mail because she made such a fuss about it. It was in the L.A. papers. There was a letter that came in the mail, and it said on the envelope, away with democracy. Teach the Constitution in the schools. That's what it said in the upper left corner.
Wow.
I still have that letter.
So
that's in the mid-50s.
Yeah, so this is nothing new. Let's talk about the racial aspect of it for a moment. The lesson that the Republicans seem to have learned from Youngkin's victory was that if you yell and scream about critical race theory being taught in the schools, then Republicans turn out to vote. And it seems to me like this really has nothing to do with critical race theory. It has everything to do with white Republicans being uncomfortable simply with the actual history of America being taught. Can you speak to that? What are the consequences of that? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't cause a 9-year-old, now you've got, the example you gave, a 9-year-old white girl coming home and saying, I'm ashamed of my skin. The opposite example I would offer would be, the 9-year-old black girl who's, the one of very, very few in an all-white school coming home and saying, I'm being persecuted because of the color of my skin. It's like, how do we try to race neutralize things, or is that even possible or desirable?
Well, one of the problems in teaching is that you have to remember that children see the world in terms of either or. They don't see things in complexity. So you're either white or you're black. You're either this or you're that. It's an all or nothing kind of phase in life. That's why kids are comparing who's the best baseball player or who's the best this. They can't think that both, what example it would be, two quarterbacks like Tom Brady and some other quarterback could both be great. Why do we have to have one that's the greatest? But that's how people think when they're in their 8, 9, 10 years old. So it can be about how they're educated and how they're taught in school. But what I think is important is that Republicans, white Republicans, are afraid of losing their world, which is a world that has been their world since slavery and since forever. And all of a sudden, it seems, there are people who are very uncomfortable with diversity, and they feel that it's dangerous and it threatens them. And so they're afraid of otherness, of blacks, of Latinos, of all kinds of things. And fear is really a big thing. And racism, I mean, it's really hard to go into the whole thing about racism right now. But I do think that's what motivates a lot of Republicans.
Yeah.
However, I think a lot of black voters didn't turn up to vote in Virginia. In other words, I think there's a baseline of Republican white voters who are going to come out, whether it's Youngkin or Trump. The question is, how many other voters are going to come out on the Democratic side? And I think that a lot of the black voters who voted for Biden have felt let down.
Yeah.
Disappointed. And they didn't show up.
I have heard that on this program. It'd be interesting to do an analysis of the vote. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, a psychoanalyst and clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at George Washington University, the author of Trump on the Couch and his previous Bush and Obama on the Couch books. Justin Frank, MD, on Twitter. Dr. Frank, if we just pull race out of the equation for a moment. As you pointed out, back in the 1950s, the whole Republican freakout was about teaching about the United Nations in our schools, which is not a racial issue. I suppose you could argue, you know, most of the world isn't Caucasian, but still, I don't think it was a racial issue as much as it was, you know, the demagoguery of
the Red Scare.
There you go.
Communists, right. About Russia, about taking away our rights and our freedoms.
Right. So why is it that when these kinds of issues come up, people on the right target education? Is it that point you were making earlier that you know, parents? Well, hey, let me just make it open. Why is it?
Well, education is the molding of children. So parents want their children molded in their own image. And if their own image is one of the only way to be safe is to be all white or to have no communists under your bed or no black people under your bed, depending on what decade you're talking about, whether it's the 50s or this decade. As long as there's somebody who's not dangerous around, that's the goal. And education has to do with certain values and that they think are important, but that unconsciously there is a hatred of reality always, because the problem with material external reality is it forces people to have to think and make choices and do work. Thinking is work. I love talking with you, Tom, because you help me think. But I also know that I was nervous before I come on your show because I know I'm going to have to work hard to try to make sense of the things we're talking about better. And thinking. Thinking is work. The parents want things that are pat, that are memorized, that the children will learn to be like them. They really have a problem tolerating their children's autonomy, their individuality, their separation, their growth. It is very hard for people to have children who grow up to be not at all like me, quote. My favorite cartoon of one last thing, years ago when I was a younger guy, it was in the New Yorker, and there were these two hippies sitting on the floor smoking whatever they were smoking with long hair, husband and wife, and there's a little kid walking in between the two of them carrying a briefcase and a suit. He was about 5 years old, and they looked at each other and they said, "Where did we go wrong?"
Right. So
I think that's an issue.
No, I get it.
In other words, children are narcissistic extensions of the family, of the parents,
right,
in some ways.
But there's this authoritarian streak in the Republican Party, or in general, any right-wing party anywhere in the world. And it seems like that's what's being active. Well, let me bring up this question on the other side of this break. We'll be back.
Okay.
We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank of George Washington University, psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry, and his most recent book, Trump on the Couch. Hopefully he's working on Biden on the Couch. We'll see that. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, clinical professor of psychiatry at George Washington, author of Trump on the Couch, Bush on the Couch, Obama on the Couch. Hopefully one of these days, Biden on the Couch. Are you working on that?
Well, I've decided to work on something more ambitious, which is something that's akin to America on the couch. Because Biden is an amazing person, and I could do that, but I think I've done enough with individuals. If I were going to summarize Biden on the couch, though, I could do it in one sentence that's very clear to me, which is that sorrow is the vitamin of growth and strength.
You know, it has often occurred to me that many of the people I've known in the healing professions are themselves deeply wounded, particularly in the areas
yes.
that they particularly work. And I have always thought that Joe Biden was quite literally the wounded healer.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
So back to our conversation we were having a moment ago about right-wing opposition to education. Robert Altmaier wrote a book called The Authoritarians about a decade and a half ago. John Dean, in fact, wrote a book called Conservatives Without Conscience based on Altmaier's book. And then he more recently wrote a book with Altmaier about this topic. And Altmaier's proposal or proposition is that about 20% of us in any human population are authoritarian-leaning kinds of folks. Just do it my way, damn it. And that those kind of folks, and then John Dean takes that and says those kind of folks are the ones who show up in the Republican Party generally, and only rarely in the Democratic Party. Does that tell us, if that's true, does that tell us that this education issue, you know, we want our kids to grow up to be nice little robots who respect our values and nobody else's, is something that would really resonate well for Republicans, but for Democrats would be a relatively meaningless argument?
It's a bit of a polarizing question, although I do get what you're talking about. I think that everybody has some yearnings for an authoritarian leader, but I think Democrats are able to put those yearnings into perspective so they won't necessarily fall for it. But I do think that people do have yearnings for it. In fact, when Roosevelt was elected during the time between his election and inauguration, which was a longer time than it is now, until March 4th, there were lots of people who wanted him to become a benevolent dictator, including Ickes and a couple of other advisors. And he said, absolutely not. I want to be pushed by the people, and I want the people to push me. And that was how Roosevelt understood that yearning. People have that yearning. The Republicans take advantage of that yearning, and they do attract people who are much more clear about wanting to follow the leader. So one of the things that I notice as a psychoanalyst, just individually, is that a lot of people give me more credit than I should have in my office because I'm the expert on their unconscious. I know more about them sometimes than they feel they know about themselves, and that's just not true. I know certain things that they may not have thought about, but they give me a level of expertise that is not quite fair. But there is a yearning for an authoritarian figure to tell them what to do, to tell them, do not be afraid, I will take care of things.
It's like we're all little kids deep down inside.
We all were.
Yeah.
We aren't now only, but we were all of us.
Yep.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. Dr. Justin Frank is with us, professor of psychiatry at George Washington University, clinical professor and psychoanalyst, MD, Dr. Frank, Justin Frank, MD. Dr. Frank, we were talking about the idea of authoritarianism and people wanting leaders and how, kind of deep down inside, we're all still little kids, I suppose, or that little child is still within us all. You look at these so-called great men who have dominated history, Hitler, Mussolini, Napoleon, and so on. And, over the years, I recall reading these debates about whether the great man theory of history is real or whether these people simply emerged out of a time that was definitely going to produce someone like them. And it was the circumstances, not the personality. And that leads me to wonder, did Donald Trump step into a space that was already open, or is there something unique about his personality that makes him a particular danger to democracy in the United States? Would a Tom Cotton or a Josh Hawley, or I'm guessing you don't want to get so specific, but would another Republican who maybe shares the same views be nowhere near as dangerous because they have a different personality? To what extent are these so-called great men and women unique in their positions and their power because of their personalities versus the circumstances that put them there?
Well, what about comparing Donald Trump to Tony Soprano?
Okay.
And what about talking about the yearning for a mob boss to make other people feel safe?
Well, you could also argue that Tony Soprano got where he was, were he a real character, by being, a tough guy, a bully, by having a personality that was sort of like Donald Trump, that was, willing to just ride roughshod over others.
That's what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying that Trump is like Tony Soprano and is like a mob boss who can make you feel protected if you're on his side and will destroy anything that gets in his way and will find a different way to destroy them. What makes Donald Trump different from Tony Soprano is that although Tony Soprano is a fictional character, Tony Soprano seems to actually love his own family. And I don't think Donald Trump loves anybody particularly. I think that Donald Trump is a fundamentally person who's hell-bent on being destructive. He loves destruction. He loves breaking things. He promised infrastructure for 4 years and then never delivered. And then as soon as Biden delivers, Trump attacks it because he hates structure, because structure is limiting. Mm-hmm. And as a great, powerful man stepping into the government, he hates the structure of Congress. He hated the structure of the press. He made them into the enemy. He made laws into the enemy. He talked about losers who were buried in wars, who fought for America because they were killed. McCain was a loser. So he really breaks things down. So I don't think that as a strong man, he did step into a vacuum in a way. I think that Obama left a vacuum because people were yearning for a strong leader, and Obama was not a strong leader. And in my book about Obama, I did write that he suffered from obsessional bipartisan disorder, that he felt people just had to get along no matter what. And he would immediately become friends with Bob Dole and different right-wing people rather than the people who got him elected. Hmm. And he has stayed that way. So he was not a strong leader. And so people were looking for somebody who's strong. And I have to say, in Trump's own way, he was a very strong person, but he was not a visionary person. The great man theory that you're talking about, you did leave out Roosevelt, who I think was a great man. Mm-hmm. At least that's the only American, and Martin Luther King, but he never became president. Usually the great men in America get assassinated, like
Lincoln.
great leaders like Lincoln, like Martin Luther King. But I thought you played something very important in one of your breaks earlier that I was listening to. Was about you. Was that a Jimmy Carter quote?
Yeah, I can play it right now if you'd like, because most people didn't hear that break.
Oh, most people didn't hear it.
No, that only plays on our nonprofit radio station. So
would you play it?
I would. This is from 19. Let's see. This is the last
78
year.
78 or not?
Yeah. No, I think it's 79. I think it's the last. Yeah. Maybe even early 1980. Jimmy Carter has proposed some serious legislation here, and he put up the solar panels on the roof of the White House. And here is what he has to say. It's in two parts.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts. And we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then he goes on to talk about solar power, which is
moreover,
right
I will
here.
Soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
It's heartbreaking.
Okay, I have a look. Can I say some thoughts about this?
Please.
Okay, first of all, that is a visionary leader.
Yes.
If he were allowed to be a great man, and I think he had it in him, Jimmy Carter could have been a great man. But he was attacked by the press because he was a thinking man, and he paid attention to telling us to do things that involved sacrifice. So he would wear a sweater in the White House rather than turn up the heat. And that upset a lot of people. What's wrong with a president wearing a sweater? This is terrible leadership. This is not a strong man. This is not an authority figure. He's a person who is forcing us to think and face reality. And this circles full round to the beginning of our discussion today, which is the hatred of learning, the hatred of education, the attack on thinking, the attack on linking. And all of us unconsciously, not only do we have yearnings for an authority, we have another problem unconsciously, which is that we're very attracted to non-thought. It's much easier to not have to do the work of thinking, so to leave things in terms of either or, and just have absolutes so we don't have to think. And that's where the yearning for an authoritarian figure is about, because democracy is a noun. It's not a verb. It's something that we have to think about and protect and work towards protecting. And since the beginning of Trump's presidency, we've had a full-fledged attack on democracy. And to fight for democracy involves conceptualizing that fight as a marathon and not a sprint. That this is a long process that has to be addressed directly and clearly, which I think is what you're doing on your show. What Jimmy Carter did was, the term he used really got to me, hearing it a second time, I want to put up a solar bank. The idea of a bank involves savings. The idea of a bank involves combating debt. He's saying we're not going to rely on foreign oil that was greater than in 1977. So he's aware of the debt. And what the Republicans do is they complain about government spending and they complain about the debt, but actually they're the ones who always have the debt, and then Clinton comes to office and gets rid of the debt, or Obama comes to office and gets rid of the debt, both for the most part. And then they increase the debt under Trump with the tax breaks, et cetera. Everybody knows those stories. But there's another kind of debt that the Republicans don't give a damn about, pardon my French, and that's the debt that is climate debt. That every time we drill, every time we take things from the earth, we are creating a new situation of future debt. So my children and grandchildren and yours and theirs are going to have to pay for that debt. And God knows what it's going to be like in terms of the future and global warming. But they're going to have to pay for it. Carter understood that. So he could have been a great leader. But that brings me to the second point that we were talking about before about Youngkin and the campaigns and the candidates. And that is that it is true about racism and some of these things, but it's also true that you can't really have a great leader without a free press. And what we have had now is not just not a free press, but we've had a press that is free to lie and not have any breaks or corrections on it. There used to be a State of the Union, and then you'd make a anti-State of the Union or whatever it was. But what Fox is doing is they run like Pravda. They're the Pravda of America. And they tell you what's true and what isn't, and that's it. And that's very dangerous. You can never have a true democracy with Fox News, I'm sorry. And I don't know how to deal with that, but that's a fact in my mind. That's a serious fact. And when they talk about fair and balanced, that means that if you think the moon is made out of green cheese, you get equal time to a person who says the moon is made of minerals. Yeah. That's what fair and balance means.
This was,
to Fox News.
You know, over in Australia, Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, wrote an op-ed for the Sydney Morning Herald 2 years ago titled, "Rupert Murdoch is the cancer at the heart of Australian democracy." And then he goes on to point out UK democracy and American democracy as well. It's really a thought-provoking piece. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, psychoanalyst and clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University, author of Trump on the Couch, among other books. You can follow him on Twitter at JustinFrankMD, spelled just like it sounds.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So how do we defend ourselves against these kind of people? We'll continue this conversation with Dr. Frank in just a moment. So, Dr. Frank, we've talked about, you know, the dark side of great men, or the bad side of great men, you know, the Hitler, Trump destroyers, as opposed to the Carter, FDR builders. How do we, as a society, and perhaps more consequentially, how do we individually do both societal and political battle with such people and the forces that they bring with them? And also, how do we prevent that from destroying us internally?
Well, it's there. I wish I could answer that, or we could answer that together, but I think it's an ongoing process. There is not one sudden answer. But the main answer for me right now, and this is at the beginning phase, is the concept of relentlessness, that we have to relentlessly fight for human freedom, for freedom of speech, for democracy, and against certain kinds of corporate greed and destructiveness, et cetera, and against racism. But you can only be relentless if there's a ray of hope. Otherwise, you give up. And one of the things that's really important, I would like to address at least one aspect of it, which is that we are very much dominated, all of us, including from children, really, is an all-or-none philosophy. And that if we think about all-or-none, we end up with despair. Because if we're not enough, we are nothing. And that's just not good. And so I think when you say, how do we fight against all of this, the first way is to not think in terms of all or nothing. Because one of us, or you and me alone, and all the people who are listening, can't be enough. But we can be part of a process that's an ongoing battle. And part of the ongoing battle involves doing something really old-fashioned, maybe, like we did during the Vietnam War, of having teach-ins, of having groups of people talking like you and I are talking, and have groups of people talking and questioning and discussing what's going on in the world. We have to talk about the fact that everybody, the people who are on Trump's side, feel robbed. We're feeling robbed of Biden and robbed of our democracy by these by the January 6th. But the people who attacked the Capitol feel robbed by the electoral system, which is not true. But as long as Fox News exists and Rupert Murdoch, it's going to be seen as true. And so we're going to be in, constantly in a different kind of battle from something that's shared as Americans, where we have different points of view. We're now having a battle about what's real and what isn't, and what's true and what isn't. And that reminds me of my work on the psychotic patients. And one of the ways to work with psychotic people, and I hate to call the Republicans psychotic, but in some ways they are, because they are out of touch with reality. They don't accept the fact that Biden won the election. That's psychotic to me. The way you deal with them is that you have to listen to them. And you have to say, I can really see what you're talking about. But you have to work with them. But you have to confront them. And we have to document every day, like what you do in your program. We have to document examples of the erosion of democracy and of the good things, so we have a record of what's been going on individually.
Yeah, and we get it. I get it. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Trump on the Couch and others. And Dr. Frank, we were talking about defending ourselves against these kind of crazed personalities and as a society as well, and then wandered into discussing right-wing media. I'm wondering how, in your mind, we should best deal with the kind of crisis that could happen next year, or in 2024, more likely, if either Republicans lose, this could be local races, statewide races, or even federally, and refuse to acknowledge that loss and try to basically bring the system down around us, or if Republicans seize power, if for example, the 1876 scenario where you get several states, let's say, Wisconsin, Texas, Florida, Georgia, that submit multiple ballots, multiple elector slates, and as a result, there's not a clear winner. So the election gets thrown into the House. 30 states are controlled by Republicans. The House says, okay, Donald Trump is president in 2024, even though he lost the electoral vote and he lost the popular vote. How do we deal with that? By the way, we have about 2 minutes, I think.
Oh, well, sure, I can solve this one in 2 minutes.
You're right.
Thank you for having me in the
Don't you think we should be steeling ourselves right now, though? I mean, we should be talking about this?
Well, let's start with a couple of basic things. I think we talked about it already, about what to do, which is about teach-ins and connection and people getting together. And we have to have groups that are organized and that work together. I don't know who's going to call them and organize it, and there will be organizers, hopefully, that will step up and do it. I do think that there's a group of people now who are very interested in the concept of a declaration of interdependence and not just a declaration of independence. And we need to face the fact that we are interdependent, not just right now. People have been trying to talk about it globally, and of course that doesn't work. But in this country, we have to remember that we're interdependent, and that when you have bad water in Flint, Michigan, that's going to affect some wealthy person in Telluride. I just think it will. And I don't think it is seen as an immediate thing. But if there's interdependent understanding, I think that we will begin to face that kind of problem. And it has to be together. Mm-hmm. The power is that what Freud wrote about, my first mentor, not that I ever knew him, but he said that the rule of law, which is what America is about, is always a problem because it interferes with the feeling of wanting to be free to do whatever you want. Okay. And therefore, the rule of law limits people. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can people see that the rule of law can help people grow? That doing certain things like doing your homework will help you succeed in later in life, or doing certain things where the parents set down rules, or rules of respect, or rules of being able to listen to other people. All of those things can help in growth and development. And as Harry Truman said, if you want to think like, if you want to live like a Republican, vote Democratic.
There you go. Dr. Justin Frank, you can follow him on Twitter at Justin Frank MD, his most recent book, Trump on the Couch. Dr. Frank, thanks so much for dropping by today. Great talking with you.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us. That includes you. So get out there, get active. Join up with there's some great groups out there doing great work. Tag You're It. Or have a great afternoon. Be good to yourself and the people around you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.